Hello, No Code Nation. I'm Ayush, and you're listening to my No Code story. And this is not your typical entrepreneurship podcast. Here, you get to listen to real people who are building cool stuff, all without writing a single line of code. This is the future of independent entrepreneurship, and you have a front row seat. I am so excited to share this one with you guys. Today's story has so many tangible takeaways for new no-code users that I think I'm going to recommend this episode as a start here for people interested in the no-code space. My guest on the show today is Seth Fannin, and I think he shared information about 10 no-code tools in the first 10 minutes, absolutely jam-packed with info. We dig into what Seth learned from his failures and spend a ton of time on defining the no-code space, specifically talking about enterprise no-code. And we did something that's a first for the show, a use case jam, where we spent 5 minutes going through a bunch of no-code use cases for small enterprise teams. I think I'm going to be doing more of those. Enough said. I'm thrilled that Seth agreed to be on, and I hope that you get a ton out of this story. Here's my conversation with Seth Fannin.
My name is Seth, and this is my no-code story.
All right. Hey, Seth. Welcome. Welcome to the show.
Hey, how's it going? Thanks for having me.
It's really nice to have you on the show. I know you've been a longtime listener of the podcast as well, so thank you. We've been in touch on Twitter for a long time. I've had the podcast for about 5 months, so yeah. I think we got connected in the early days when I only had two or three episodes out. So thanks for supporting the pod, and I really appreciate you coming on now. I'm really stoked to talk about some of the topics out here, but welcome to the show.
Thanks, yeah.
Why don't you go ahead and tell our audience a little bit about yourself and what your background has been, what you do on a day-to-day basis, and how you got inserted into the no-code space.
Yeah, so for me, I don't come from a traditional technical background or startups or even the tech community. I am a military veteran. I got out about 8 years ago. I traditionally fell into the defense and government public sector, as a lot of veterans might do, working in project management, supply chain, across different domains, program management. I'm now a project manager. I basically over time sort of developed a passion for like product management and trying to build my own apps, just like I think a lot of us here, trying to learn CSS, HTML, JavaScript, some of the same, you know, things that we're all trying to accomplish is or building our own tools and apps. So I think back in 2018, just came across back in the early days when it was BenTossel, Card was the big thing.
Yeah.
Webflow was rolling out. I mean, so I went down the rabbit hole, and I didn't even have a Twitter at the time. I mean, I just was like, okay, well, this is where it seems to be at. What is this no code word? What does that mean?
It's funny you say those are the early days. That's probably just like 2 years back, right?
And it's changed so much that it feels that way. It's rapidly moving. The ecosystem, the people, the tools, and what you can do with the tools have just changed literally month by month. I mean, but pretty much I got into that. I followed down the rabbit hole, and I've always been somewhat technical savvy, you know, being able to get around and do things on the internet. So I was always interested in building my own startups. So I kind of just taught myself products, startups, and things that I wasn't doing in my job. I guess I wasn't getting that desire fulfilled in me at work. So I would go and build, you know, my solutions. And I started out building Card, you know, just following the footsteps and learning from others on Twitter, you know. So here I am now, and I'm just trying to do the same as everyone else and build my own business eventually.
That's awesome to hear. And for a lot of people, with the ultimate goal being to build something on their own without having to spend the amount of time required to, you know, learn to code and also build a team at the same time, I think no-code tools give a very interesting opportunity, especially with the evolution that we're seeing take place in front of our eyes. How do you look at the no-code space? I know we kind of talk about Card, for example, and Webflow as examples of no-code tools. But really, when you start to abstract the concept, how do you look at different tools in the no-code space in terms of benefits that they can drive for specific use cases?
Well, I think, you know, I try to visualize it in my head and try to dissect it from, you know, the no-code term. And, you know, it's a marketing buzzword. We all know, you know, like I said, no-code has been around. We know that for many years, but it just wasn't called anything. People were just doing it. they were just doing it as their, you know, whether it was a habit or whether it was, you know, out of creation to build things, Dreamweaver, you know, Microsoft Word. I mean, those are the first versions of really like doing any kind of process, you know, creation. I think that ultimately, you know, no code is code in building blocks, just layered. You know, like, I think the inflection points of technology have enabled these tools to actually make those come to reality, you know. And I think that, you know, there is a difference, you know, in no code and this low code thing. Predict that, you know, low code is still in the adoption phase, I think, especially when in enterprises we see that are like heavily regulated ones, especially. I think it's going to be, it takes some more time for that. We are seeing enterprises use it, and, you know, just the, and then you have the other side of no code where you see a lot more consumer apps. You know, maybe you want to build something with less security. It doesn't require as much security or as much input. It's a personal tool for yourself. I think that the use cases are really broad, you know? So, I mean, we definitely, I think it's basically, what is your requirements? What are you building? Are you building for yourself? Are you trying to build a business? I mean, because, you know, then there are other factors involved as far as, you know, data, security, compliance, et cetera.
Absolutely. I think some of those concepts actually apply to enterprises more than whether the tool is a low code or no code tool to a certain extent. But I think you're right in that enterprises might naturally gravitate towards tools that have more extensibility, where you can extend the functionality by adding a couple of lines of code. Whereas for the end user that's just trying to get an MVP out, you know, they're just interested in getting something out the door quick, even if it has 80% of the functionality they're looking for.
Yeah, like on Twitter, you see, you know, the average person, he's a solo maker, right? He's building for himself or trying to validate an idea. And that's ultimately the main, you know, thing that no code is great for. I mean, it's allowed us to say, hey, I want to test this. Do people want this? Will they buy it? I can build a landing page now. I don't have to hire a developer. Speed, yeah. Cost, function.
So you've been in this space for a couple of years now. Talk about what products or what solutions are available to maybe a new user that's coming up that has stumbled upon this space recently. And what do they have at their disposal in terms of if they want to build a website, a landing page, and sell something online versus if they want to build an app either for just broad consumption on the web or on a mobile device, or if they want to build something for their team if they're on their enterprise? How do you think about the different tools that are available right now in each of these spaces?
Yeah, I mean, now there's, you know, it's so vast now, the amount of tools we have available compared to even a couple of years back. And it's usually when somebody asks me, what is the easy landing page builder or what is the first tool I should use? I usually say, you know what, build a simple website with card. You can't go wrong. It's drag and drop, you know, 30 minutes to an hour. You can have a simple page and it's probably the most user-friendly when it comes to easiest. But what I learned, it took me a long while to, I mean, I'm still trying to learn. I learn new things every day about the use case of tools, and maybe I use too many tools. Like, what tools should I use? I mean, there's definitely learning curves to some of these tools, but as far as like building a website, Webflow, I love Webflow. I started using it in 2019, I think. And, you know, it takes some time to learn, but, you know, it's really another amazing solution. Doric. There's Pori, there's Softr. If you want to build let's say a Bubble, I love Bubble. I'm learning it right now, still learning it. But Bubble, you can build a, you know, native or just build web apps, you know, SaaS web apps, login functionality, manage your backend and front end. And the reason why I like Bubble a lot is because of, I think that it bundles a lot of these tools into one, and it really reduces your tool stack a lot. You know, you really don't have to rely on pulling so many of these applications together in Zapier or Integromat to glue them together to make them work. And you can really utilize APIs and just it's advanced more. There's that. And then there, I kind of look at the mobile side, Glide, Adalo. I think Glide is great for like internal apps, like small tools for teams. I think Adalo is just getting really powerful. It's changing. They're really like growing the features and, you know, just releasing, like, create the ability to build native apps now with Adalo is pretty impressive. And you see a lot of other use cases for, you know, Zapier, like Airtable, for example, data management apps or info products. I love Airtable. We all, you know, Airtable seems to be, you know, heavily used in vast amount of products, and the way people use them is pretty interesting because I still see new things every day, whether it's marketing themselves mm-hmm. as a growth tool or just embedding into your website. I mean, it's pretty impressive what people are doing with it.
That's a cool listing of tools. What's if you think about enterprise applications, so let's say I'm on a team, you know, a few people that all we do is work on data, but we need to manage data coming through multiple systems. We need to maybe build internal applications. What are some tools that you've seen in this space? Because obviously you do this on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of these tools, and unfortunately some of these tools I would love to use in my regular job, and I'm not allowed.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's the problem too. You know, it's mm-hmm. a fighting problem that I'm trying to solve and understand. I think that a lot of these applications, there's like a Microsoft Power Apps, because I mean, you see a lot of enterprises running on Microsoft or Office 365.
Right.
It's heavily embedded in many organizations across the world. If you're already using Outlook, you're already using Teams, you're running on SharePoint, not a big fan, but life goes on. But there's a now Microsoft has rolled out their low-code tools to build on top of Microsoft Azure or what used to be Access and Power BI. You can build data tables, and yeah, it is a little bit more complex, I think, because I don't think the UI of these tools are the greatest, but the functionality is more powerful for sure. For let's say you want to build a data layer, you want to take all your Azure database, you want to turn it into a SharePoint list. I mean, there are tons of Microsoft Power Apps solutions for that. I really do think that if you're already using in your ecosystem Microsoft, use Microsoft Power Apps. It's gonna integrate easier. But there are other solutions, you know, as far as unbundling, like Uncork is trying to build the solutions for compliance, you know, into these different regulated industries like HIPAA and just different areas, you know, insurance. OutSystems is a big one. I don't know too much about them, but I'm interested in looking into it. Retool.io seems to be pretty powerful, and to allow developers, right, to move faster, not have to use traditional systems.
Yeah, and what's really interesting is a lot of these companies that have been traditional leaders in not only the enterprise space, but also enterprise systems in general, right? So Google Cloud, Azure, and AWS. So all of the parent companies have started to make plays in the low-code and no-code space. So Microsoft, obviously, you talked about the Power App platform. Google acquired AppSheet and turned it into a product that you can use under Google Workspaces to build your own internal apps. And the company that I work for, we're a Google shop. So that has a lot of potential applications for us internally. And if you think about AWS, apps that are built on AWS and just Honeycode, the whole ecosystem for Honeycode, you know, lends itself to ease of development and stuff like that. So I think some of the bigwigs have started to pay attention. SAP acquired AppGuire, right? So there's a lot of...
I heard about that, yeah. And Integromat was, I think, also acquired by another data large company as well. I forgot the name. But like you said, yeah, you're seeing all these acquisitions, which is a very clear indicator that, you know, these organizations definitely don't want to be left behind when it comes to grabbing a part of that market. Yeah, I think that you're definitely going to see more of this. I think that could hurt some of these tools, though, obviously, because through acquisitions, sometimes when large companies acquire some of these tools, some people argue that some of these tools will lose maybe some of its gist, right, or usability, or the UX, or just the product, the support will go down. And that is definitely a risk, you know, I think of acquisitions like this, right? But as far as the space growing, it's a very indicator that it's not going anywhere. Especially if Microsoft and Google are willing to spend big money on, you know, these small players and build them up.
Yeah, and just in terms of defining the space, one of the interesting things that I keep coming back to, one of the interesting definitions is Chris Yin from Scale actually published something a while back, this is at least a year back, that's basically a framework for low-code and no-code development. And essentially what it ends up becoming is then translation of an internal to an external use case. So internal being where you use something for an internal team, and external being where you build something for the masses, and a business user and a development user, right? Where the business user is essentially trying to extrapolate, you know, data and trying to understand data, visualize it, etc. And there's a whole host of applications around it. And the dev user, that's a whole sort of behind the scenes set of applications where, you know, we had someone from Okta, Arville from Okta on the pod. And
yeah, listen to that. Yeah.
Yeah, he was a group product manager at Okta, and what they do is something with respect to identity that's really embedded into a company's fabric, right? So we use it on a day-to-day basis. And there are a whole host of dev applications to no-code tools that traditionally would have required code that I think the adoption there is probably going to be much higher, but nobody's talking about it because few people actually know about these use cases.
Yeah, you're right about that. I mean, like I, you know, try to do as much user interviews within my own company as I can from time to time. And I'll learn that, okay, yeah, we're, you know, using Salesforce. I can just tell by our intranet, our intranet website for our company. But at the same time, there's no awareness of, oh, well, here pretty soon, you're going to be able to connect your Okta with your Salesforce and this and do this and that. But there, you're right. I think what, behind the scenes on the enterprise side, it's funny because, I mean, why don't we hear about it on Twitter, no code too much? You know what I mean? Like, you're right. It is because, like, I think it's a culture. I don't even think it's a tool issue. I think it's a culture. The, you know, these legacy large companies, right, that are matured. I mean, it's true that there is some culture issues probably that have to do with the selection of, you know, changing the way things are done within IT teams, DevOps, business ops. So I think that over time, one of our jobs as a community is to obviously educate these larger executives, these large companies.
Yeah, and the message for someone that's new in the space is that there's more than one way to frame this out, right? There's more than one way to think about the space. And what is important is defining your use case and finding a tool that best fits your needs. And the good news is there's a wide assortment of products, just like you outlined there, Seth, that fit a wide variety of use cases and user experiences. Let's dig into, for a second, low-code and no-code. The question I get asked often is, isn't low code always better than no code because you can extend it? And sometimes I've said maybe, but most of the times my answer is maybe not, because you're potentially exposing your internal teams to more options than they have time to, you know, deal with and manage on an ongoing basis. What are your thoughts on that? Which one's better?
Yeah, so I guess if we were speaking and using in an enterprise setting, like internal teams that want to build custom apps for internal use, I would definitely say that low code is either already, if it's already integrated or you have the power to use or choose, definitely I would say go with low code, because yes, I do think that some of these low code tools like RPA and customization, they definitely have lack on the design aspect, but it's not about that. It's about function. It's about connecting data points across teams and silos and being able to make decisions faster. And I do understand at the same time the constraint against IT departments, you know, afraid of being a shadow IT, right? The thing that's been occurring for years and years and years, you know, just if an application touches customer data, that is an issue. And that is something to be aware of, like that has to be thought about, you know? So these low code apps tend to be a lot more powerful as in security wise, but you're in an enterprise setting, that's probably going to be more, I guess, adopted and probably welcomed just because of the culture and, you know, the jobs to be done. Right. So, but yeah, you're right. I really don't think it has to do with like better. It's about what are you doing, your resources, your skills. I mean, as an organization, where are you? Are you a private company? Are you a public company? Or also ask the question of, this is a service-based company. It's not a product company, you know, and you don't hear it too often, but I mean, from my experience, I've worked in service companies like I do now.
Right.
You know, it's mostly managing and pushing the needle forward to the customer, especially on these data points. And that's where things get siloed. And there's no communication layer. But as far as, yeah, like you said, it's about the environment and then setting. No code tools are, you know, like I said, better UI for sure. Better, maybe a little bit easier also as far as complexity to actually put them together, and probably faster, definitely. But you're right, the security constraints would be concerning to me, I think, you know, definitely. If I were you know, if I had worked at a company where I had maybe 12,000 customers, you know, like, especially, and you also got to think about some of these large companies have customers that also give them the requirements. It's the other way around, especially in a government public sector setting, you know, like you have customers that actually define how they receive and deliver, you deliver that to them. Right. So it does put limitations. And I think it's the full scope. You just got to kind of understand.
So let's do something fun. Mm-hmm. I was thinking we could do kind of a use case jam, right? Where we've talked about enterprise no code for a while, and we may have, you know, people listening that work in a specific team that are wondering what are some of the use cases out there for enterprises or enterprise teams to use low code and no code tools. So let's kind of rapid fire go through a few use cases, what you think they mean, like what are some of the requirements, and if you have a tool or two that you would recommend for some of those, what would that be like?
Yeah, and it goes basically off of, you know, you kind of ask yourself, what is already established in the infrastructure of my company? What is available to me as an employee? If I'm running on SharePoint, right, and I don't like SharePoint, you can, you know, a lot of organizations build on top of it and customize it. But now you can connect it with, I think there's a couple of apps called Nintech where you can build workflows and just kind of hand off the delivery of some of those going back and forth within SharePoint. Mm-hmm. You can now use Power Apps to make your list, SharePoint lists and document libraries more powerful or just more user-friendly as far as in visual. I think there's a lot of opportunity there, just data tables in general. Spreadsheets, reducing spreadsheets is always, you know, think I'll have that, you know, I've seen that, the handoffs. That's the biggest challenge that I've always had with spreadsheets is to reduce the amount of handoffs between employees. With Power Apps, you can build a data portal with like a CRM for all of those touch points to where it'll have a approval tracking rating system, you know, to where a single source of truth, right?
Yeah.
Is some people would call it business intelligence dashboards instead of scrolling through spreadsheets. How about you just bring your SharePoint data? Maybe you want to bring your Power BI. Maybe you want to bring that all in one place, you know? It's just, I think where enterprises will really see the improvement is it necessarily won't be game-changing innovations, but those little things are going to actually move the needle big time, like saving time, productivity. Because you think about the productivity of one employee, we'll add that to hundreds, and that's really going to move the mark forward as far as, you know, what do I do today, day to day, jobs to be done.
And productivity is one aspect of it, but really reducing redundancy and improving the byproduct of some of the analytics and the data management that people do on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, extraction, reporting.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Extraction, reporting, improving consistency across teams is a big thing because I think the overarching theme across what you're saying for an enterprise team is essentially creating a data model equivalent, right? Something mm-hmm. equivalent to a simple database that operates for a team, and then building a host of user applications on top that might be like a BI dashboard, that might be just manipulating and visualizing data in different ways, combining data sets and doing database joins much more easier.
Like a spreadsheet, I don't want to have to, you know, build a spreadsheet for a process, send it out over Outlook and have hundreds of people chime in on an email and send different versions, because that's also a problem, versioning, right? It eliminates versioning in the cloud.
Exactly.
And SharePoint is good, I think, you know, like as far as, you know, it's good for document versioning, definitely. File versioning, it has its power there.
But what it does still is it just keeps track of the versions.
Yeah.
You're still stuck reconciling those
versions.
You're
still stuck, yeah, trying to get those in one central place.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's going to be interesting to see what comes. I'm always on the lookout for things, but you're right, to have one center of truth, like a data model, like you said, I actually want to be able to see real-time status from all the stakeholders, all the different business silos. I want to be able to see, oh, this has been approved. I don't want really to, I shouldn't have to go and ask, hey, where is this? What is the status of this? You know, why in SharePoint, you definitely see that that's a problem is there's the business teams and are usually siloed. Even in SharePoint, right? There's separate own sites, they're separate own. You have to get permission, the permission layer to go back and forth to see some data that you rely on to do your job. And so it's there's a lot of different inputs and outputs on that.
And I think the underlying message there too is being able to empower creative individuals within teams to build their own solution that is scalable, where it reduces friction, it eliminates redundant data capture and maintenance, and it also automates certain aspects of data processing in some way, where you're pulling data from a system, running it through a batch of checks, and then, you know, making it part of your existing database, for example, right?
Yeah.
So you could automate that aspect of data intake as well. Cool. This was awesome. I think this would have really benefited someone that's maybe new in an analyst role or new on a team to, you know, look at what's possible. And of course, you know, make sure that you stay within the construct of your organization. So make sure that, you know, any customer data, any internal data is not exposed to a solution without express permission and all of those common sense things. But at the same time, there are a vast variety of tools out there that you could use based on your use case.
Yeah. I think that, it's like you said, once that inflection starts happening and organizations are more open-minded, I think that's when the ball will start rolling, because you know it's just going to trigger down to the employee or that business analyst saying, oh well, I've always done this way in a spreadsheet, I'm comfortable using like this. So I think that once the education layer will kick in, once the some kind of way of doing things changes, kind of like a not being an agile environment, you know, this will all trickle into each other when culture and education start moving and changing some of those things.
Let's dig into personal projects and side hustles for a second. So what are some of your favorite tool sets to use on a day-to-day basis when you're working on non-work related projects?
You know, right now I'm definitely, you know, I'm kind of all over the place. I love the B2B side, trying to find solutions, but then I love the consumer side, just like a lot of people do. I've used a lot of different things. I use Airtable a lot for just personal dashboards, Notion. I built DocDrop.io on Webflow, Gumroad, MailChimp, Zapier. So I use those on a day-to-day basis. I'd say Airtable definitely a lot on a day-to-day basis, even when I'm not building, you know, just for information, you know, for personal dashboards that I might use. As far as a building, definitely I'm playing a lot with Bubble right now, a lot.
And what's the learning curve been like? Because I've heard a lot of stories.
Yeah,
like, first of all, how far in are you? Like, how many days, and what's the journey been like?
I'm a couple months into it. Like, definitely. So for me, you know, and this goes back to, like, also, I think, you know, as you see different people in the ecosystem, like on Twitter and such, I think it really depends on lifestyle. Like, you know, if you have a full-time job, you're married, you have kids, your time is limited. So, I fall in that category of, I don't, you know, I'm not single. I don't have all the time in the world. I don't, you know, so definitely I have to be selective in like what I build and when. I'm not going to get 10 projects a year out. I'm not. That's just the truth. I might be lucky to get 2 or 3. So actually pretty far, I guess, along in the Bubble stack, but I choose to learn what I need to build because my time is limited. So I definitely am planning on building a micro SaaS or a marketplace. I'm doing a right now in the customer research phase, talking to users, because I've also learned that, you know, I'm not going to just build products that are not going to solve a problem. Now I've learned that, you know, I need to be solving a problem and I need to talk to people,
right?
You know, the right way, you know, and take that time to do it. So I'm relying on Bubble to help me, you know, get that solution, that first MVP solution. And I'm just playing around right now and really just trying to learn how I want to use it and what integrations do I want to use with it. Or do I want to use all custom, you know, just all Bubble natively? So I'm kind of just exploring, you know, as far as what I want to build and going from there. You know, I'm kind of in between right now on projects as well.
That's awesome. Tell us a bit about DocDrop though, because it sounded like you kind of pulled together a bunch of different solutions to create that product. So just talk about what's possible even in early stages of someone's no-code journey.
Yeah, so DocDrop was my first attempt at an info product, and I learned so much from what I failed. It was awesome. I love it. I mean, that's the best part of failing, and it's learning the next time of what not to do and what I did right and what I did wrong. So it was my first attempt at an info product. It was a digital, it was basically, Doctor, I love product management and I'm trying to move into product management. I'm trying to leverage my no code because of my background, not in tech, trying to move into that. So basically all the things over the years that I've learned about product management, all the content, the product leaders, et cetera, I basically just built a database, a curated database of the best templates, tools, whether it be blogs or just information all in one place for people that want to, aspiring product managers or current new or new product managers, you know, that just want to be more up to speed on who should I follow, who are the product leaders that have really defined, you know, the space in the last 10 years or so, what kind of tools are there templates available? So I've gone out and done the research and curated, and I basically just took that and I put it in an Airtable database, refined some of the information. I built a landing page in Webflow. I also host the Airtable in Webflow as well. So basically person will go, they'll purchase, whether it be from Gumroad directly or my landing page. So it's two different funnels. They'll purchase in Gumroad. I'm using the Zapier to notify myself. It automatically sends an email to them from MailChimp to my Gumroad customer. And I'm segmenting and tagging whether they're a Gumroad customer or they just subscribed.
Right.
So I'm learning the marketing. Marketing has been the hardest thing, you know, we all have to learn, and I'm still learning. So basically once they, in that email they get from Gumroad, they're also given a password to the database. And it's also hosted on a private Webflow page within my current domain. So it's been pretty interesting. It was a learning experience. And the name DocDrop is doesn't really go with the actual product that it is now, because I pivoted and I learned that also. A big lesson in that is, you know exactly what you kind of want to solve before you go out and buy a domain name. My actual original MVP I had in Webflow was a product hunt for public documents, and it worked. I was using JetBoost, and I was trying to, you know, just have the crowd curate all those public buried Google Docs that are never seen on the internet, that are full of useful information, right? So, but I had already purchased the domain, and I kind of changed my goal and, you know, what I was going after. So even though I haven't changed the name, I was still able to, you know, make over 25 sales and so far. And, but I'm still experimenting now, you know, with trying to have over 60 email subscribers.
Right.
And I'm trying to learn from them and see, okay, now what can I do with this one time, you know, you purchased this one time from me. How can I add value to you? Or what is I'm trying to understand, what is the movement from here? Or is this it for me from this? But at the same time, I do feel like that I want to move on to building an actual user, SaaS application as far as my personal goals. But I'm learning on DocDrop for my customers and seeing how they're using their table data and seeing if I can add value to their learning process and product.
That's great that you're still engaged with customers as you're building.
I even met with one of them. It was awesome. And he purchased that database from me. And I even met with him, had a call. He lives in Australia. It was great. And he told me everything that he was trying to do and why he would purchase this and what he... So it was pretty interesting and learning for sure for me.
And I think your story is probably reflective for someone that's new in the space, probably reflective of a typical journey, more reflective of a typical journey that someone will have in their first or second product than, you know, all the success stories that we read about, right? Where people have had successful launches and, you know, thousands or tens of thousands of subscribers and so on and so forth.
And I definitely think that has to do with time, you know, like consistency on Twitter. It's a whole nother conversation, right? Like is the Twitter growth thing, you know, it's definitely good. Building in public, I really like that. I really think that that's definitely helping a lot of people learn, you know, and get feedback from each other. I'm definitely hopefully on my way there. I mean, but I'm not necessarily trying to build for my audience on Twitter. I'm not necessarily trying to build for them. That's the thing. Also, I think it's misunderstood. Is if I'm building for a SaaS in an industry to where the customer is not on Twitter,
right?
Then I'm going to be doing my customer discovery elsewhere, either in person or calls. Or so I use Twitter as far as helping others learn. And if I ever do become, you know, successful and do that big launch one day and get that traction, then I'm going to share my processes, but not to brag, of course, just to help others, because that's really ultimately who I am and what I want out of this is just, wow, I got there. How can I help others get there the same? Because I think there's others just like me, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. What a great note to kind of end the conversation there, because I think there's a lot that I had a ton of fun talking today, and I think there's a lot that we should talk about that's probably long enough for another session. And I'd love to, you know, maybe a few weeks or months down the line, do sort of a follow-on where we not only have an update on your project, your bubble story. I really want to learn how long does it take realistically for someone to get from idea to app on Bubble, and have an example to share with my audience here. But also I want to talk about the future of this space and some of the other ideas around where enterprise IT could go. How do people that are in leadership positions in the enterprise think about organizing their teams for the future that's going to involve proliferation of no-code and low-code tools and so on. So I think there's definitely a ton that I'd love to talk to you about, but this was a phenomenal conversation. And thanks. Thank you once again, Seth, for taking the time. Why don't you give a handoff to people to where they can find you? If they have any questions, how do they get a hold of you and so on?
Yeah, I operate on Twitter. So my Twitter name handle is Fannin, FANNIN underscore Seth, SETH. So you can find me there. You can reach out and ask me any questions. Can DM me publicly in a thread. It doesn't matter. I'll help you any way I can, or just love to meet you. You know, there's so many new people every day. So I'd like to chat and just learn from you, or you learn from me, vice versa.
Great stuff. Thank you, Seth.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
All right. That was the show. Thank you for tuning in, and I hope you enjoyed it and got a ton out of it. If you did, there are two things you need to do. Number one, make sure you subscribe to the show to get notified when a new no-code story drops. And number two, I want to ask you a favor. Who's the one person you know who would absolutely benefit from hearing this story? Text them right now and send them to mynocodestory.com and reference this episode. Maybe they're an entrepreneur. Maybe they can use this episode to level up at their job. Or maybe they're just someone who loves creating new things. Do it. Subscribe and then send them the text. Make a difference. Thanks again, and I'll see you on the next one.